Today, finishing up on something to consider for this fresh new year.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
I won't rehash yesterday, just our last episode, you know, not yesterday, but we'll mention that we talked about David and then Jesus as the prime examples of people who are after God's own heart. You know, this is why they fit the messianic profile and why, obviously, Jesus being God would fulfill it most perfectly. The discussion ended up being about the reality that both use the unlimited power they have. I mean, one is a king, and so it's limited in some ways, but as far as they're concerned, he's the king. He can do anything he wants, but he uses his power for the ones who don't have it, and Jesus does exactly the same thing. And, you know, we can get uncomfortable with the language if we want or complain about the way we say it or whatever, but that's the thing that sets David apart, and that's the thing that Jesus repeatedly says we ought to do, making the point last time that at the end of the Good Samaritan story, the line that's given is go and do likewise. That statement, which we like to quote all the time, you know, well, here's the, somebody's doing you, go and do likewise. It's given in the context of the one example of life that we're supposed to follow, which is a person who has the resources to help and actually does it. They use their resources to go and help. And so there are so many other ways that we could make that point. I'm not going to make it because I want to move forward into what this actually has to do with how we could look forward to the new year. But if I were to make the point, there are just so many illustrations of it. Yesterday, Daisy brought up after the episode, the fact that very often firstborn, you know, siblings in the whole Old Testament especially, end up being excluded from the privileges they're supposed to obtain and are protected from them. And then that begins at the very beginning with the very first firstborn, Cain, who ends up being excluded from the blessing, you know, having to be sent out so that he has to establish his own city and so on. Cain, what does he do with the power he has, with that firstborn privilege that he has? He kills his brother. He doesn't protect him. He kills him. And when God comes to confront him about it, literally says, well, am I my brother's keeper? This is the opening story about how our responsibility for each other exists in the world and ends up being abused by those who are stronger. Cain and Abel starts it from the very beginning. So we could make that point over and over and over again throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. But what I want to do is step away from talking about the biblical stories that sort of lay the foundation for this concept that God's heart is one that uses his unlimited power for the sake of those who don't have it. I want to step out of that and into what it means today. So contemporary parallels to these kinds of stories or analogies or applications of this reality about our lives. And there is a little journey I want to take to try to get there, to make the point for us, and then to make some applications about it that are practical. But to understand that and to understand why I'm even bringing this up has to do with the importance of asking the questions that are behind the questions that we see. So I'll use the term meta questions. I'm not trying to be technical or, you know, highfalutin about it, as people would say. you know, not highfalutin people, but people, you know. But it's they're meta questions. They're the questions behind the questions. They're always important for us to ask. And this is what we're doing. I'm saying one of the most important meta questions is always, where's the power in this, you know? And there are a lot of people who use those expressions, and some of those people I don't agree with. But that reality that there is power present, that some people have advantages that they can use or abuse in their relationship with others, is just part of the reality of human nature. I mean, it's not a surprise. Some people are bigger than other people. Some people have more money than other people. Some people have the positions of power and other people don't, and so on. Those are always there. And that's one of the most important meta questions to ask when you're trying to figure out what's going on. Why'd they laugh at that joke? Well, maybe just because that guy who told the joke has a lot of power and they recognize it. And so they actually think his jokes are funny because they really want to cooperate with what he's doing or what she's doing. So the importance of meta questions comes into play here. So I remember 20 years ago when I began working at Criswell College, where I've been the president for the last 10 years. When I started working here 20 years ago, I lived in Arlington, and I could drive to Dallas, but, you know, effectively consume my entire paycheck on transportation. Or I could take public transportation, which takes a lot of time, but it also has some advantages. You know, you get to read and do some other things while you're in the public transit system. So back then, TRE wasn't that far from my house. I would drive to the TRE, which is the, you know, rail for people who are not in the DFW area. It's the rail that sort of goes between Dallas and Fort Worth and hits the mid-cities and gets people there. It's pretty quick. And it's pretty good. I really enjoyed that. So anyway, I would go to the TRE station from the mid-cities from, I think it was Hearst, the Hearst Bell station. And I would ride to downtown Dallas, to Union Station, and get off, and I'd get on the DART rail, light rail in Dallas. And it was fantastic. You know, you get on it, the trains come by all the time, it's constant. So you just get on the train and you go down to the next station. Well, I would go to a different downtown station that was almost to the place where I work, which is in Old East Dallas, just outside of downtown, maybe a mile from downtown. And so I, you know, would get on that DART rail and I'd go to the next stop, and I'd still be about a mile and a quarter or so from Criswell College. And so I would wait on the DART bus, which came by that station, and I would take it. And if everything worked out just right, it was fantastic. You know, get on the TRE, 30 minutes later, you're downtown Dallas. 10 minutes later, you're at the next train station, the DART rail station. And then 5 minutes after that, the DART bus comes by and picks you up. And 15 to 20 minutes later, you're at the college. Done. Okay, so it's an hour-long commute, a little more than an hour. It's fantastic and cheap. And, you know, I enjoyed it. And we had bargain back then, so it was even cheaper back then. Anyway, the point is, there were days when, so the TRE, I never really had a problem with that. Even the DART rail, the light rail, never had a problem with that. And I'm really grateful for DART buses. And if you're a DART bus driver or work for DART in any way whatsoever, thank you for your service. I am extremely grateful. But oh my soul, back then, and I'm sure it's completely different now, taking a bus was just hit or miss. It might get there at the time that it was designated to get there. It might not. I will say most of the time it did. So I was grateful for that. But there were times when it just didn't. And you would stand there and look and there was just nothing. There's nobody coming. There's nobody explaining what's going on. There's no answer to the question. You know, when's that bus going to get here? You were just sitting there looking at it and going, oh, it's 15 minutes past the time. And the next one comes in 20 more minutes. And so I would kill 30 minutes just sitting there waiting on the next bus to come, which normally came. Only once did I really get stranded like that. And you'll realize, I realized I wasn't really stranded in just a minute. So, you know, and what would happen normally is the DART rail would be 2 or 3 minutes late and I would try to get to the bus. I wouldn't make it on time. It would go. And so I'd have to wait 30 minutes for the next bus to come. Well, that means I'm eating up 30 minutes of my time trying to get to work. And 10 or 15 minutes on top of that for the bus ride that's going to follow. And, you know, honestly, sometimes it would even make me late for the class that I had that morning. So like an 8 o'clock class or something. So I finally, you know, one of these times I'm sitting there, I'm finally thinking to myself, well, you know, how fast do we walk? I mean, back then I would walk 3 or 4 miles an hour, right? So, I mean, that's just a normal walking pace. It's a slow to easy walking pace. Maybe 4 miles an hour is a little bit, you know, moving, but it's not hard. I can walk that pace, not now, but close. I might be 2.5 to 3 miles an hour now. Anyway, the point is, I'm thinking to myself, it's a mile and a quarter to work from here. If I walk, then it's going to take me 20 minutes to get to work. That's it. 20 minutes. Why am I sitting here waiting to take a 45-minute trip that I can just walk in 20 minutes? Now, on a hot day, I waited because of the sweat. But aside from that, it was easier for me just to go. What I'm getting at is this. The question behind my commute was not making the connection. Oh, no, I didn't make the bus. Now I got to wait 45 minutes. If you ask the question behind the question, then you say, well, you know, what's your goal? What are you trying to do? Trying to get the bus. No, not that. What are you actually trying to do? Well, I'm trying to get to work. Well, where's work? A mile and a quarter that way. Well, why don't you just walk? I mean, that's less time than waiting here for the bus. And I thought the goal was to get to work. You get my point. In thinking about how we approach matters in which we have agency, where we can do things, asking meta questions is how you get out of a rut. And what I mean by a rut is on both sides. Privately, we get into ruts. We get into habits that we just can't get out of. You know, I can't avoid overeating, or I can't avoid this, you know, whatever addiction that I have, or I can't get past this rant of anger that I have in traffic, or, you know, whatever it is that's bothering us. And those private ruts that we get into, like inescapable habits, if you think about it, you know, what is it that makes, like, let's say you had one that was bad enough that you finally decided, I need to go see a therapist. You know, you need to talk to somebody to make this better. What makes that therapy valuable? Now, there are 100 things that make it valuable. I'm not talking about all of those. But I mean, regarding that specific rut, why on earth, you know, you go into a place and you're like, so why do I have this habit of whatever it is, you know, of having to do this every Tuesday, whatever. And, you know, a therapist sits there and at some point, this is the joke, right? They say, well, let's talk about your relationship with your mother. I don't have a bad habit in my relationship with my mother. What are we talking about my mother? The point is, they're trying to get you to think about things you normally don't back up and think about. You don't step back and go, why do I have that attitude? Why does that threaten me? Why does that bother me? Why do I respond this way to that situation? Why does this feeling emerge? You don't think about the meta questions. You're just thinking, why do I have to have 13 bowls of Bluebell when I see this kind of show on TV, you know? So the meta questions are the things that help shake things loose, you know, get us out of that rut. And it's the same way with seemingly inevitable choices, where we feel like, well, I just don't have a choice. You know, I hate my job, but I just don't have a choice. I got to work my job. And maybe you do. Maybe that's the best choice, to go ahead and continue to work a job that you don't like. I'm not saying you don't like your job this year, make sure you quit it. I'm not saying that at all. This is quite the opposite of that. I'm saying when you feel like you have no choice, it's actually being, you know, just stuck in a rut, because you're not asking the bigger questions about where the ladders are to get out of the rut. Where's somebody putting a hand down and saying, you know, I could help you out of that rut, and you're just brushing it aside. Get your hand out of my way. I'm trying to walk down the rut. The reality is, there's a reason to back up and go, well, why is it that I feel like I don't have a choice about this? Oh, because I never understood that I could actually make decisions like that. And so in your private life, you know, with inescapable habits or inevitable choices or whatever, thinking about the meta questions, the bigger questions, the underlying questions, and in this case, questions about power and where they are and where we think they are and how we play into them and so on, can help us find our way out of a rut. And in public issues, you know, so publicly in a rut, We're going to find it most of the time for a society when there are intractable conflicts. They just never go away. Every year, year after year, the same topic comes up. I think of immigration, most obviously, as the easy example, because we've not only dug that rut, we dig it deeper every year, and we just exaggerate it as something that could never change because there is no solution. There are plenty of solutions. We just don't back up and say, why do we prefer the rut to the solution, right? So in some ways, the meta question is always going to be important because it allows us to step outside of the trap of the surface questions that we normally ask and beyond that into something where at least we can think about it differently. Sometimes thinking about it differently doesn't get us out of the rut. But sometimes it does. It can help us get out of that rut. So let me give some examples of where I'm talking about how meta questions can reveal something. And these are not new concepts. If you've been listening to my episodes, again, the point in these two episodes is not so much to introduce new ideas as just to refresh our thinking about these ideas in this year and how we can apply ourselves to behaving differently, thinking differently, developing a different attitude in the way we come at things this year. So one of the things where meta questions can help is with revealing that there really are fundamental differences in our ways of thinking about things. So for instance, with conservatism, and even in this case, by the way, and we've talked about conservatism before, but even in this case, you'll see that even where there are fundamental differences in how we think about things, there are ways that we can see each other's views and actually make some progress towards speaking with each other instead of just past each other all the time. Because, you know, in this kind of case, I'm basically describing something where I'm standing in one rut, they're standing in another rut, and we're just arguing against each other by speaking down our own rows, never speaking across to each other, never actually cross-pollinating any of our ideas. And so with conservatism, let me explain what I mean. There are two different kinds of conservatism. We've talked about this before, so I'm not going to take a long time on it. Daisy can link to the episodes where we actually talked about the different kinds of conservatism and how we need to look at those. Anyway, the point is, one form of that conservatism is about preserving institutions. This is what conservatism means. That's what you do. You conserve things the way they are, keep things the way they are. And so one traditional sort of form of conservatism is about preserving the things that already exist. And there's lots of disagreement, in fact, that exists on actual issues can be analyzed down to differences about conservation of the status quo. That's trying to conserve the current institutions, preserving the way things are right now. A lot of disagreement can come down to what we think about whether we should conserve the way things are right now or not conserve the way things are right now. And those are real differences of opinion. I mean, they can be real differences of opinion. So that's why during the civil rights movement, which was about abolishing codified institutions of segregation. We want to get rid of that. I'm talking about the old civil rights movement, you know, mid-20th century era. During that time, there was codified segregation. Jim Crow South was still active and so on. During that time, there was a legitimate difference. I'm not saying both sides had a legitimate viewpoint. Those segregational policies were absurd. And they needed to go away, and there's no defending them whatsoever. But the point is, the differences were real differences. There were people who believed segregation is the only way to go forward, and it ought to be maintained, and that's the way we've always done things, and we have to do things. And there was a viewpoint that said, and I agree with this one, obviously, and not only agree with it, morally, it's the only way that it should have been. There was a view that said, no, we have to abolish these segregating policies. They have to go away. You cannot say you love liberty or value human beings and then discard them or separate them and keep them suppressed or oppressed in this way. And so the civil rights movement, which was about abolishing codified institutions of segregation, was about, you know, overturning the status quo. And since then, by the way, racial reconciliation has been about identifying and removing the residue of those institutions, whether they're practices or attitudes or whatever. I mean, institutions very broadly. The point is, in the civil rights movement, there is, you know, you don't come at this and say, oh, well, you know, if you just understood the meta question here, you'd know segregation's really okay. It's just a different way of seeing the world. That's not my point. My point isn't that everything's right. If we all just had a broader perspective, everybody's viewpoint could all be, they could all be deemed correct, and we just have different ways of doing things. I'm not saying that. Sometimes the meta questions actually reveal where the fundamental differences are, and recognizing that can lead to conversations that more intelligently address where the problems actually lie. It's not just a matter of saying, well, I love black people too, but I just think they ought to have their own churches. You know, that's a person who's thinking, oh, well, it's just on the surface. I mean, that's all that's going on. They're not thinking at all about the fact that what they're trying to do in conserving institutions is also maintaining this oppression of an entire group of human beings. I'm choosing an easy topic to begin with because we're 60 years removed from that civil rights movement's overcoming of at least codified, and I mean literally in written law and regulation and statutes and so on, that kind of codified segregation. So it's an easy topic, an easy example to give. But it's the same, exactly the same thing with law and order politics. So when you hear that term, law and order, you probably, in most of the people who are in my circles, they hear it and they just think, you know, it's an innocuous term. Well, who wouldn't like law and order? They don't hear what is referred to in other circles as a dog whistle, a way of saying, you know, we want to keep those rabble rousers, those people who are different from us, we want to keep them down. We don't want them getting loose and changing our society. And so law and order politics can be about, and it is simply about, preserving institutions of enforcement. And that's, you know, whether it's with the police or with systems of incarceration or whatever it is, you know, it's about preserving those institutions of enforcement. The point of those institutions of enforcement, though, that we may or may not pay attention to, is sometimes that they're enforcing rules that are designed to keep, you know, somebody in their place. And that's, you know, that's that distribution of power, you know, is being used in that circumstance, in that occasion, sometimes in a way that might not be to everyone's advantage. That's just part of the reality of what goes on. Now, is it something you disagree with or agree with? Discussion for another day, maybe for later today. The point is, the underlying question is about what's being preserved. Who's keeping the standard that they have? Speaking of standards, that's why the gold standard for the U.S. dollar was a matter of conservatism in that same way. You know, we're going to preserve this standard. It has to have a gold standard behind it. The dollar's value is going to be linked to gold. It's just keeping things the way they had been. Resistance to new energy sources, even. I know people who just, they see these wind turbines going down the road, these 400-mile-long wind turbines that are going, you know, I'm exaggerating, I'm joking. Like, you know, however long they are, they're ridiculously long, but these huge things go up, and they collect wind energy, and, you know, people criticize them as if they're somehow evil, because if the wind stops blowing, where are you going to get electricity? You know, I hear things like that, and I'm like, well, yeah, I guess engineers probably need to figure that out, but does that make a wind turbine evil? It's not about that. The meta question regarding new energy sources, whether it's solar or wind or nuclear or whatever it is what it does to the oil industry, right? I mean, because we have a well-established oil industry, and we could talk about that later and cover more details in it, but at the bottom of it is whether we're interested in conserving the way we do things right now, Or if somebody's willing to consider some up-and-coming technologies to do things differently. I'm making it sound like inherently the up-and-coming is better. Not the case. Sometimes it's better, sometimes it's not better. But the issue goes beyond whether a wind turbine is better than oil in a barrel. That's not the ultimate question. The question is, what does the infrastructure of our country look like? Where are the people who have the power who are establishing how we draw that energy? And the truth of the matter is, the people who are looking forward, who have the power that comes from having sold oil for generations, are also investing in the wind turbines, and they're investing in nuclear, and they're investing in everything else. So that's, you know, just an example with conservatism. Okay, the other form of conservatism, by the way, is the one that maximizes liberties. It's libertarianism, right? That's the idea. And in that case, you're always dealing with disagreements about which liberties are most important. And they will analyze up to different issues. So, for instance, with abortion, and we've talked about this one before, so I'll do it very briefly. But, you know, on one side, you have this value for individual liberties is being expressed with the value of reproductive liberty. That's on the pro-choice side. I should be able to make my own choice about whether I'm going to have a child or not. It's my body. You know, don't mess with my body. All those claims are libertarian types of claims. And on the other side is the question about the scope of personal liberty. So those who are on my side, on the right to life side, would say, look, you know, a baby has a right to life too, and we should protect that child while it's in the womb. It's a value of personal liberty. But I don't have to look at the people who are on the other side of the aisle and say, they don't care about personal liberty. That's not true. Or say, they don't care about life. That's not true. It doesn't mean they don't care about life, but they do care about reproductive liberty, and that's what they're advocating for. And I can understand that. Now I can have a discussion with them, an argument even with them, where I'm advocating for the life of every unborn child. I can have that argument, understanding that I'm talking to a human being who actually does share some values with me. Again, we've had all of that discussion in previous episodes. I'm not trying to rehash it. The same thing comes up in this libertarian side of conservatism. Same thing comes up with controlled substances. The idea of personal liberty is, you know, going to say, let's just make drugs legal. Let's get rid of, you know, decriminalize or just make them legal altogether. And it's sort of advocating for libertarian license. You get to do what you want to do, and nobody should tell you to do otherwise. And it takes a paternalistic state to keep you from being able to use whatever drugs turn you on, as long as you're not hurting other people, you know, and so on. On the other side, those who are advocating, and a lot of traditional conservatives, those who are preserving the institutions, would argue on this side, they would say, no, what we want are preemptive protections of your liberty. Because when you become addicted, when you give yourself over to these things, you lose your competence. And we want your liberty to be protected. There are preemptive protections of autonomy. So on controlled substances, you can understand the meta question. Well, what are we trying to do? Are we trying to take people's power away? I don't want you to make your own choices about drugs. Or are we trying to give people power? I want you to be able to make bigger choices about life than just being addicted to a drug. I don't agree with both of those, obviously. I would lean one way or the other. But the point is, they're both arguing in terms of individual liberties. So look, let me get back to the point for the discussion today. The remaining question, you know, where David's model that we talked about, where he's taking an unbelievable amount of power he has, the great warrior and so on, and applying it to those who don't have it, meeting their needs. And Jesus' model, the same thing, doing the same thing. He's omnipotent. And yet he's giving himself to those who are weak, who are not able to accomplish anything. Where does their model fit into the question that we're talking about today? So, for instance, what is the traditional form of conservatism? What does it do with the power that it has? So, I mean, the given is that it conserves current power. That's given. That's what it means to be that traditional kind of conservative. The question is it possible for traditional conservatism to be brought to heel with God's heart? Is it possible that you could actually say, well, I am trying to conserve some forms of current institutional power, But I'm trying to do that because I think some of those conservative powers that exist could be used for the sake of those who don't have it. Every branch of government has the ability to serve that end. They can do that. The legislature can pass laws that protect those who are vulnerable. The courts can make judgments, decisions that actually defend the interests of people who are being abused by others. That can happen. You can have executives in office who are enforcing laws on the basis that they respect those who are most vulnerable among us. There's nothing even difficult about conceiving of an end of preserving a government like that. What we have to ask ourselves when we're establishing that government, when we're voting or deciding to serve in that government or protesting it or, you know, posting on social media, is whether we're acting in our own interest or in the interest of others. Are we using that blather that we put out there? I'm a conservative, they're a liberal, look at that Marxist. When we're throwing all those terms out there, if we're throwing them out there because we just want to win the argument or get the issue to go our way, or if we're actually thinking to ourselves, is this going to help someone I'm supposed to be helping with the power I have? If I put it on the other side, instead of traditional conservatism, libertarian conservatism, what does it do with power? Well, on the abortion side, like we were talking about, the positive side of both sides, the pro-life side can explicitly speak on behalf of the unborn, those who are weakest among us. The pro-choice side can explicitly advocate for a class of people who have been commoditized and controlled throughout history. Women literally sold and bartered for their reproductive power and then sometimes kept in exactly that same position. The pro-choice side can advocate for that. On the downside, the pro-life side can overlook the disparity created for women if government's invited to control whatever happens after sex, but only with women, because men are just marching off scot-free. They're not under any of these regulations whatsoever. And on the pro-choice side, they can completely suppress what should be a natural empathy and sympathy that we feel for these tiny little lives that are developing in utero. The question in all of those cases isn't about whether you value liberty or not. It's not about whether you value life or not. It's about what you're doing with the power that you have. Are you using it for those who don't have that power? With controlled substances, it's exactly the same way. On the positive side of libertarian conservatism, a drug restriction can prevent, you know, what can amount to human trafficking and enslavement. That's just the reality of it. Because, you know, you become addicted and you're brought into that world where you just don't have control over your life anymore. And that's not an advocation for liberty. It's similar to, by the way, arguments I would make about laws against legalized prostitution. There's just too much power disparity between a dealer and an addict, or in this case, between a sex trafficker and a sex worker, for it to make any sense that that's somehow advocating for liberty. Drug legalization and decriminalization, on the other hand, is taking control away from the big government, the bureaucracy that wants to control people's lives. I understand why people would argue on both sides of that. So, you know, by the way, if you want an example of that, you can think of it in terms of the conspiracy and disempowerment that was talked about when hydroxychloroquine was restricted during COVID. I'm not an advocate of that stuff. I want to mess with it, and I don't care about it. I don't care whether you love it or hate it either, by the way, so I don't need your emails and texts about it. The point is that the way people were responding to that was largely shaped by a question about power. You're telling me I can't have this drug? If I want to have this drug, I ought to be able to get it. I'm going to go down to the veterinarian and get my own. That response wasn't just people saying, I know more about science than you do. It was also people whose power had been taken away from them saying, I'm taking my power back. I'm doing what I want to do. Now, I'm not advocating for or against that. I'm saying the meta question was about who gets to make the decision, right? That's what the thing was with masks. People didn't know whether masks helped or not. What they cared about was whether somebody was dictating to them whether they had to wear one or not. And, you know, again, I'm not advocating for or against them. I wore a mask. We enforced it at our college. I was all in favor of listening to the biggest experts about it, which were the people in the government. And I don't even trust a lot of people in the government. But the reality is they were the experts. So we just did that. But the question became about who's got the power and who's going to be able to hold it. It's the normal small government argument, which, by the way, is itself part of understanding this schizophrenia that's at the heart of conservatism, where on one side we want to promote personal liberty and on the other side we want to conserve the institutions of government that violate personal liberties, by the way. So, there are a thousand examples we can give like that. I mentioned that I would talk about guns. I'll mention that real quickly, and about deregulation here. Two examples really quickly. And these are cases where they don't just reveal a difference, but they're cases where the meta question can extrude opposing problems and opposing solutions, but for the same reason. So like with guns, if you think back to why guns were considered valuable to begin with and why we would have a Second Amendment, you know, the well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The reason we have that is because the concept of the, you know, the old Colt, I think it was Colt, equalizer, you know, that gun allows a weaker person to be able to defend themselves, and now everyone's equal, right? The idea is a preservation of those liberties. Over time, there's sort of an alternative theme that rises and competes with that in the gun world all the time, and you see it regularly, and that's of having more power than other people, a bigger gun, the ability to use that gun, and the macho image that goes with it, and almost the ability to promote like personal autonomy, but beyond personal autonomy, sort of anarchy in the sense of decentralizing social control so that nobody's ever going to tell me what to do. The government's not coming on my property. If they come to take my guns, they'll get them one piece at a time. You know, that kind of response isn't about protecting the weak. It is about saying, I have got as much power or more than anyone else, and I'm going to preserve it no matter what. Those two ideas about what guns mean are in competition with each other. And if you think about it, the people who are advocating for gun control, the reasonable people that I know who are advocating for gun control, they're doing it because they want to protect people who are vulnerable. I mean, for crying out loud, kids go to school and they feel threatened about who's going to show up with a gun and start shooting in their classroom. It's insane. And we're not trying to make our country the old West again, are we? I mean, we're not trying to say, oh, well, every kid ought to have a gun. Then they can just fight it out in the schoolyard. That's not going to help with anything. So, you know, what on earth? So you can understand the argument, right? On the other side, the people who don't want their guns taken away are saying, all you do is set us all up to be targeted by the people who do have power, including the government, if you take our guns away. What they're doing is arguing about who's got the power and trying to protect some group that they see as being weaker if they don't have that power. You can understand in the meta question of it, at least, a better place for us to meet together and discuss the issue. I'd say the same thing in a complete, you know, much less inflammatory topic. When we talk about free enterprise or deregulation, as we talk about it later, you know, originally the idea is just to allow entrepreneurs to act without bureaucratic restraint. And that promotes freedom for people who don't have resources otherwise. You know, I'm going to set up a lemonade stand, and then over time I'm going to make quarters and dollars until I can finally put up a real store. And then I have a storefront, I'll make enough money, I can franchise it and sell it to other people and have a fruit juice empire. I'm going to rule the world through fruit juice. Whatever it is, the point is that we're saying we want people to be able to do that without these unnecessary restrictions. At the same time, allowing established corporations to act without any bureaucratic restraint whatsoever seems to consolidate power in a center other than the government. It's the corporation, right? And then the individual is just excluded. So that's why you have antitrust laws and fair trade practices and laws against fraud and all this stuff. And so you come back and you say, well, I wish we had a laissez-faire environment, economic environment, and that the rule was caveat emptor. You know, it's up to the buyer to beware. But all that does is set up a class of victims, right? So those who favor regulation can favor the regulation because they don't want large corporations taking advantage of people. But those who oppose the regulations can do that because they don't want large bureaucracies crushing people who are just trying to be creative. The point is, you can have people who are on the opposite sides of those two issues doing it because they're both trying to keep power from abusing people who are weak. The power is just in different centers in those cases. So let me give you a handful of practical applications of what I'm talking about. All those examples just to say you can see that there are always meta questions behind the things that we're talking about. What is the point for today? Let me give you about three, right? One, use this tool of backing up and asking the question behind the question. And in particular, this one, the power question. Use this tool the same way you use any other analytic tool, to help you understand why people whose opinions are so different from yours might hold those opinions. Gaining the ability to empathize with a person we disagree with doesn't make us weaker. More knowledge, more understanding is never a bad thing. Understanding implicitly connects us with others by giving us a sort of a common sense of the knowledge that we have. I have a footing in this that I can share with others, and I can actually explain to others, and now I can explain why their ideas are different from mine or whatever. It gives us understanding. That kind of analysis gives us the ability to use our strength or our knowledge, our power, in a way that doesn't immediately discard the person or their value who thinks about it differently. And if we know them better and we come to agree with them, that's not a threat. Then, you know, what's happened? Oh, no, I learned something and I grew. Oh, heaven forbid. You know, if we know them better and we still disagree, then we have a better chance of spanning the chasm between us and them, either to help them change their view or to make our separately opinionated lives tolerable together in the society where we're stuck living side by side. That's a big part of the reason I'm even talking about this. That side by side reality, especially as we approach a brand new administration in 2025, that side by side reality is, you know, so important. Lately, we've been using elections more and more with a view to imposing our wins on the rest of the country, or with the expectation that all the people who disagree with us really have no more voice since they lost the election. But in truth, the people who lost the election, they don't leave the country just because they lost, even when they threaten to, or promise to, depending on your opinion of them. They don't lose their rights just because they lost an election. And their ideas are no more wrong or right than they were before the election. In other words, when we think of elections, what we need to consider is that what we're trying to do with them overall might be different than just imposing our will on the rest of society. Are we using elections simply to consolidate power to our advantage, or are we using elections to express our desire to be part of a system that invites and respects the input of every person? That's what an election does. When you participate in a vote, you cannot simply be going to say, I have to win. You have to participate in a vote, if it's meaningful as a vote, recognizing that you are expressing your respect for the other people who are voting, no matter how weak they might be otherwise. That's why everybody gets one vote. That's the conflict that emerges about voter restrictions, by the way, one of the topics we could have talked about today. You know, one group, hey, illegal votes, disenfranchise legitimate votes. We need to make sure and get out all the illegal votes, filter all of those out of the system, put up restrictions. The other group is saying every voter restriction filters out as many or more legal votes as it does illegal ones. Because some classes of legal voters are very easily intimidated or deterred from participating in elections. There's a reason that both sides are saying what they're saying that has to do with respecting the people who are participating. The bigger question is, do we respect the people who ought to be participating in the election, and do we treat them with that respect? So my point is, if you can use these analytic tools, they can help us to treat other people with more respect. It seems like a good thing. Second, rethink the basis of persistent problems, especially in light of established power and those who are traditionally excluded from it. If you rethink the question of what's going on in Israel and Palestine right now, and even Syria and beyond in the Middle East, then you start thinking differently than the simple expressions that we give to, you know, just cheap answers, cheap rhetorical answers to the problems of the Middle East and picking one side over the other and not recognizing a lot of suffering is going on both sides right now. And that's who needs advocacy, those who are suffering at the hands of the conflict that's going on. And I could go on and on all of these, our dependence on oil. And these are just persistent problems. They're always there. And they always bring about some challenges, and we never solve them. So, you know, if we can back up and say, well, I wonder why that's persistent. I wonder why it stays there. Why is the Middle East conflict still there? Why is there still a dependence on oil? Why does the government interfere in our daily lives on a regular basis? Why is there the criminal justice system in America the most prolific in the world, incarcerating more of our people than anyone else in the world? Why do we do that? Why is racism a persistent problem? Why is immigration a persistent problem? Asking those questions in terms of the meta question, and in this case, the more important question about who's trying to preserve power, who's keeping power. And then not just they're villainous, oh, those people have power, they must be terrible, but are they using that power for the sake of those they're supposed to serve, of those who don't have that power? Those are the questions we ought to be asking. Third, decide, this is more personal, what you're going to do with your power this year. You have power. You can say, I don't have any power. I'm a lowly college student. I can't do it. Or, you know, I used to have a job. I don't have a job. I'm unemployed. I barely get around. I don't have any power at all. Everybody has power of some kind or another. So decide what you're going to do with the power that you do have, with the money you have, with the job or professional connections you have, with your family and friends network, with your education, or with your gifts and talents and skills. That's a power. What are you going to do with them this year? How are you going to use them? And if you just say, oh, I've got power to solve my own problems, okay, that is part of what we do with our power. That's good. Solve your problems. I'm happy for you. But that's not why God created you. We do more than that. We help the people who don't have the power we do have. It doesn't mean they don't have any power, but they may not have the power we do have, and we can help them with whatever that thing is that you pick out. So decide what you're going to do with your power this year. Why does God have you here with the ability to do what you have the ability to do? There's some reason for it. So let me conclude. Using wealth as the epitome of power, and it's not the only epitome, but it is a big one, as Paul says to Timothy. I'm going to leave you with what Paul gives Timothy to teach to those who have it. I'm just going to read you his words, and that's my end. As for the rich, Paul says to Timothy, that is, those with the wherewithal to do things or get things done, as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, not to set their hopes on those riches for their own uncertain gains in this world, but instead on God, who abundantly provides us with everything to enjoy. So what are they supposed to do? They should do good. To be rich, not just with the power they have, with the money they have, but in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.